Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. The 13th annual Berkshire International Film Festival will showcase 80 of the latest independent feature, documentary, short, and family films from 28 countries. From May 31st to June 3rd in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and from June 1st to the 3rd in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. The festival features screenings of these films and various special events, including three Tea Talks. One of this year's Tea Talks features Berkshire-based Academy Award-winning filmmaker Cynthia Wade and a screening of her new documentary, Grit. Grit is co-directed and co-produced by Wade and Sasha Friedlander and follows the lives of Indonesian citizens in East Jakarta displaced from their villages when an underground mudflow, struck by a natural gas drill, bubbles up and buries their homes and everything they own beneath 60 feet of mud. Cynthia Wade joins us now to tell us more. Cynthia, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you.
You made this film co-produced, co-directed with Sasha Friedlander, and she has a connection to Indonesia. Does she become your connection to Indonesia?
Yes, Sasha was my connection to Indonesia. I discovered this story in 2012 while working over in Indonesia on another project and thought, wow, I've never heard of this giant, massive mud disaster. How come I've never heard of this? But knew that this would be a years-long project, many, many years, where I would be raising money and writing grants. And I really needed to partner with somebody who really understood the language and the culture and the traditions. And Sasha is a documentary filmmaker who has spent half of her life in Indonesia, is fluent in the language, has worked as a reporter in Jakarta. So I approached her rather blindly and said, would you like to partner with me on this film? It's a funny thing with a film because it's like a marriage. You actually don't know how many years it's going to go.
Right.
And you really are, for better for worse, with that other person through thick and thin. It's been an amazing partnership. And together we made the film over 6 years.
It must have been helpful to have a partner who was fluent in the language, because it is, I don't know if I've ever heard much, it's not Indonesian, but the local dialect.
Bahasa.
Thank you. Spoken before, but is, you know, if you're only used to romance languages and English, it's very, very different. So it must have been incredibly helpful to have a partner who was fluent.
Absolutely. And of course, they're always in production, even in English-speaking countries, there are always these sort of lost in translation moments all of the time, often in the stress and chaos of production. But particularly if you're ever working in a place where you don't speak the language, it was incredibly helpful for Sasha to be able to pick things up just out of the corner of her ear and say, oh, I just heard this, or he just said that, or we really need to switch the schedule around so that we can go film this.
Let's talk about the details of the disaster. In 2006, a company drilling for natural gas hit, best described, I think, as a volcano of mud that came up and has been flowing ever since then.
Yes. Some scientists are calling it an underground volcano of mud that was just there.
Okay.
Others say it was just a giant pocket of mud, but essentially this incredibly hot, boiling mud, massive. This drill hit the mud. The mud spurted, rushed to the surface, exploded, killed people in the process, and then began to cover and sink 16 villages under 60 feet of mud. And it continues to this day.
And the projected end, or like an estimated time it might stop doing that, isn't for more than 10 more years.
Correct.
And the drilling company has tried to say they didn't do it.
Correct.
I mean, just from these few sentences we've just exchanged, there is so much there to tell, to try to understand. How did you approach that story as you made your film with Sasha?
This film was a particular challenge because there is a layer of environmental story, and then there's a layer of political story of, you know, who becomes the next president of Indonesia. And that was critical to the story because depending on who was elected president, the plight of the mudflow survivors would go in radically different directions. And then, of course, it's a personal story. It's a personal narrative of one girl being raised by her single mother in a community where they realize if they don't rise up and fight back, nothing's going to change.
How did you find Dion and her family?
We did a lot of casting and a lot of shooting. And honestly, this is true in documentary. We followed three families democratically for 5 straight years. So
wow.
I have Dion's story. I have also in 2 other family stories. And of course, it's incredibly painful when you sit down in the edit. And a lot of this was edited at the Sundance Edit Lab over a couple of summers. When we realized that it would be a better, more focused, more personal story just telling it through Dion, it's very hard to let go of those other stories. but it made sense because over the course of 6 years, we really see her grow up. She starts as a very young teenager, and she ends up as a young woman, as an adult at the end of the film.
How do you, for the people that you filmed, Dionne and the others who you had to ultimately cut out, approach them, convince them, etc.?
In the beginning, the survivors were fatigued because we appeared to be maybe just like another news crew. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of news crews had come in and had told the story of the mud flow and then had disappeared.
Right.
And of course, then the survivors felt like, well, why did we do all of that if nothing is going to help benefit us in our story? When we kept returning and kept returning and kept returning over the period of years, there finally was a breaking down of walls and of barriers, and we ended up getting quite close. Sasha actually right now, as I speak, is in Indonesia with Dionne, which is really great. Just not for work, just because she wanted to go see Dionne.
That's wonderful. You interview the head of Lapindo Drilling Company. You do speak with him on film, and he's confident and brazen. And I mean, you couldn't, from my perspective, and I'm sure a shared perspective with a lot of people, you couldn't write a better corporate villain. But he agreed to be in the movie. So how did that happen?
It took 5 years.
I bet.
It took 5 years. He doesn't normally do interviews. Mm-hmm. And he has tried to distance himself from this disaster. He was the Minister of Welfare when this disaster happened. He also owned this massive company, this drilling company, among many companies. And it took a really long time to convince him. It was really a matter of figuring out who his spokesperson was and then reaching out to the spokesperson and then going into New York City and meeting with the spokesperson when he was in town and then more Skypes and more emails. And then the spokesperson said, well, why don't you go to Los Angeles? His brother, the CEO's brother, will be in Los Angeles. Meet with him, and then meeting with him and raising the money to go to Los Angeles and then meeting with the nephew. And there were many, many, many layers. And finally, there was this tiny little window. And we were just about to finish the film, and this happens in documentary. We were ready to finish the film, and we got this interview, which, of course, changes everything in the narrative. So we stopped editing. We quickly raised some more money. We put together a crew, a small crew, and we flew across to Indonesia, around the world, to get this interview. And we got there. The spokesperson said, oh, he doesn't think he wants to do the interview. He'd like to back out, which happens in documentary. So it was a matter then of being on the ground and saying, but we're here and we want to be able to hear you and we want to hear your side of the story. And the truth is he talks. We left his words in. He speaks for himself.
How do you, and you're an accomplished documentarian, you're always doing some version of this. Not that any story is the same, but you're always working, like you said a number of times in what you just said, raising money, going places, getting things. How do you keep up that passion and drive when you can't get the thing you want? What is it about this career and this path that you've chosen that makes you work so hard at it for so many years now?
I think part of it is if there's a story that needs to be told and it hasn't been told, there's such a sense of, but we have to tell this story. People need to know. I mean, who knew that this land twice the size of Central Park is exploding in this massive mud disaster explosion and has been for 12 years and will for another 10 or 15 or 20 more. And most of us has never heard of it. That 16 villages could be 60 feet under the mud. That's the kind of thing where I think, well, we have to get this story out. We have to tell it. And so for me, it's just about being able to be a conduit and to find untold or underrepresented stories and connect them to an audience.
What do the people who've been displaced now for more than a decade need?
I think it's really important for people, for their stories to be told, for them to be heard. I think first and foremost, and at the center of everything, people need to be able to be heard and feel heard. And that can be huge in terms of healing and in terms of being able to move on. I think for us here, this is a cautionary tale. This is a tale of a company that cut corners and then distanced itself when this massive disaster happened. And it's also a tale of how corporate interests can get very muddied and can really threaten the democratic process, which is what happens in the film. You know, if you have corporate interests and money and corporate money that are then influencing a democratic election, and we film this massive historic presidential election in Indonesia, and we see people going out into the streets because they want to vote for the leader that they feel is going to bring restitution to this massive tragedy, It's really important for us to be thinking about what does true democracy look like, and what does it mean to show up, and what does it mean to resist?
There is an aspect of the disaster that is, again, I know I said this about the head of the company, you couldn't write a better villain, but it is a very, I found, like, bizarre thing where, so the landscape is demolished.
It's
described
like the
as
moon.
Like being
it is
lunar.
Like the moon.
Exactly. It's totally just mud. But there is tourism around that. Could you tell us more about how that manifests, what that looks like?
So imagine, as far as the eye can see, it looks like the moon. I mean, it's just lunar landscape, and there's howling wind. And in the distance, you can see these giant plumes of smoke and gas, and then huge explosions of mud. But you can walk for miles on the surface of this. And sometimes in some seasons, it's very hard mud. And of course, in monsoon season, you can just kind of sink into it. It's incredibly thick and viscous and sort of angry looking. And the people that did survive ended up kind of pulling themselves to the top of this plateau of mud that goes on and on and on. And they create this kind of ecosystem of tourism, this disaster tourism. So you can actually go to TripAdvisor.com and you can look up the Lapindo Mudflow site, and it gets 3 out of 5 stars on TripAdvisor. There are buses now of mostly curious urban Indonesians coming from larger city centers who show up in big buses and climb the stairs up this plateau. And then the villagers that I worked with have little motorbikes, and they have DVDs, and they also polish stones from the mud site, and they sell, and they interpret, and they take the tourists across this vast landscape, and they give them tours. So there's this really bizarre quality of where art and commerce and disaster kind of smash into each other on this site.
I guess it's not unlike Pompeii, except that it's so recent.
Yes.
What are you working on next? Do you have a lot of projects going at once, or...?
I find that in order to sustain this career, I need to have several projects going. It's sort of like having different pots on the stove. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one might be in a very slow boil and then one might be ready to serve. So I've got several pots. I really split my time up between a little bit of fiction, mostly documentary, and then commercial work. And you just try to make sure that none of those pots burn.
The film is beautifully made, beautifully edited, compelling, and incredibly upsetting. I hope you have a wonderful time at BIFF, and thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
The 13th Annual Berkshire International Film Festival presents a Tea Talk screening of Grit at the Mehewi in Great Barrington, Massachusetts on Saturday, June 2nd at 1:30 p.m. To learn more, visit biffma.org, biffma.org. Links to more information are posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable.